Oh, how are you doing? Here we go.
Late starting this morning, but we have a really important bill before us, Representative Rosenthal's bill on homeless youth, and then we also have an informational hearing on housing, the Housing Solutions Act. So let's go ahead and get started. Representative Rosenthal, you're up, and welcome to the hot seat in your committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and very few members. I'd like to move House File 1432 for possible inclusion in the Housing, Finance, and Public
House File Health. 1432 is removed for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Great.
There you go.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. On any given night in Minnesota, there are 1,800 unaccompanied homeless youth. House File 1432 outlines strategies for prevention and intervention to assure youth who are aging out of their own state systems do not end up homeless, and it gives a support, a safety net for those youth who do become homeless. Today, this committee will hear how taking together, improving systems for aging out of foster care systems, and providing base funding for a safety net can position Minnesota to move forward in ending youth homelessness. Perhaps more importantly for today, we seek to provide each youth with targeted investments that need to become fully, so they may become fully contributing adults as they seek to integrate into our communities and become productive members of our society. And we do have a number of testifiers today. And I would like to call them up.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kirsten Anderson-Sembridge. I serve as the Director of Advocacy at Lutheran Social Service in Minnesota and play a convening role for the Youth Moving Forward Coalition. Thank you for hearing this important bill that includes the most urgently needed prevention and intervention measures to position Minnesota toward ending youth homelessness. The bill before you is composed out of insights offered by youth-serving organizations, county and state staff, homeless youth service providers, out-of-home placement providers, advocates, and other supportive parties across the state. Though diverse in background, this unique task has come together due to one shared passion, a commitment to supporting youth in transition, and an acknowledgement that we must engage our state in becoming part of the solution. This vision is for youth in care, for youth on the streets, for all youth whose safety net broke when crisis hit, whose resilience leads them to seek support, whose determination will lead them to making incredible contributions to our society, if we have the wisdom to assure the most basic support in their most critical time of need. You and this body have already made strategic choices in support of youth in transition. In 2006, you passed the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, defining the continuum of services for homeless youth. In 2007, you funded the act at $1 million. During the 2008 session, you took steps to hold the foster care system accountable for working with youth to develop the skills for independent living by requiring a court review of progress toward their independent living plan. While the research data states that over 70% of homeless youth have experienced an out-of-home placement, we are committed to improving our own system of protection and care for kids so that fewer kids age out into homelessness. In 2009, we come before you to encourage this agenda that assures all youth who age out of care have medical coverage up to the age of 21, allow youth who run from care after the age of 15 or who age out of care to return for supports after the age of 21, preserve certain assets of youth in care for them to access as they turn 18, and invest in the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, a continuum of services for homeless youth, including street outreach, drop-in centers, shelter, and transitional housing. As you will hear from Dr. Cohen, the results of your $1 million investment in the Runaway Homeless Youth Act are striking. These dollars are distributed to 19 youth-serving organizations, 8 in greater Minnesota. The investment helps to assure programs remain open, help leverage other sources of funding, and most importantly, a third over 7,000 youth in a housing crisis receive some help from caring professionals. We celebrate the impact you made, and yet we know that this investment did not meet the need. In 2007, DHS estimated 22,410 occurrences of youth homelessness annually. And now, while the research identifies as 1,800 youth experiencing homelessness on any given night in the state of Minnesota. With those numbers in mind, and a great portion of Minnesota without services for youth, DHS staff recently provided an estimated assessment of what fully funding the continuum of youth services statewide would mean. The result? $46 million would be required to fully fund the continuum for youth to meet the most basic needs of homeless youth by covering shelter, transitional living, and street outreach, and creating new services in geographic areas where youth currently have no service options aside from seeking supports and safety on the oftentimes lonely and dangerous streets of our urban areas. We are not asking for $46 million today. Instead, we are seeking your support for homeless youth and ask of $8 million to meet present and growing needs in existing and much-needed service, particularly in greater Minnesota. And we make a plea to continue what was begun in 2007 by holding the floor on the $1 million investment in the Runaway Homeless Youth Act. We wish we had a different story to tell, that vulnerable youth had the supports they need when they were in crisis and the providers could count on basic funding to sustain these invaluable services. At LSS, we provide 23 separate areas of service and have a presence in all 87 counties. We know with increasing clarity the real funding challenges facing all human services. And yet, with every chance available, our CEO, Mark Peterson, shares with public officials that homeless youth services are the most challenging services to piece together funding for, where we have the least clarity in our public policy system to meet needs. It is for that reason that we are before you today. Our Youth Moving Forward team has dug into the federal stimulus plans, looking for a way to fund services with disappointing results. Only scattered site transitional living could be eligible for funds with the youth serving continuum. We present this agenda today as a whole strategy for assuring that our children, the 600 youth who age out of state care every year, and the 1,800 youth who are homeless on any given night in Minnesota, can gain the stability, opportunity, and connections they need for successful transition into adulthood. Today, we focus much of the testimony on the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act as the most pertinent topic for the committee. We, however, are grateful to our author and the chair for inviting this agenda to come before you as an integrated whole. Prevention through improvements in the child welfare system and intervention in the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act are equally essential for us to achieve our unifying vision that all youth have safety, opportunities, connection, essential ingredients for success, and perhaps, more importantly, for hope.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Dr. Barry Cohen. I'm the Executive Director of Rainbow Research in Minneapolis. We're a Minneapolis-based not-for-profit research firm. Been in business now for 35 years. We've been providing technical assistance to the Department of Human Services in the evaluation of 19 programs throughout Minnesota funded under the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. And these programs, as was mentioned, cover street outreach, drop-in centers, emergency shelters, transitional living programs that serve some of the 1,800 youth who we believe are homeless each night in Minnesota, as Representative Rosenthal said moments ago. And so what I'd like to present this morning are some preliminary findings from 18 focus groups, which we talked with approximately 120 youth, and from the analysis of the exit surveys that they completed at the end of each of these groups. And what I'd say is, looking at the findings that we have to date, we have here a set of programs that have really been a sound investment in the homeless and runaway youth they serve and in the communities where they live. And I'll have more to say about that. First off, the youth in these programs learned a lot. Amongst other things, they learned how to access services critical to their health, to their safety, and their well-being. And without this knowledge, they're vulnerable to exploitation, illness, and injury. Just one example, 78% of the youth said that they learned how to use public transit, access food shelves, get a free meal, and 90% of them said they had learned where to go for a safe place to stay. We know that the educational achievement, health, and safety, and the social and emotional development of children are directly impacted by the relationship that young people have with a caring adult. And the runaway and homeless youth in the programs, that the youth that we interviewed, had developed such relationships. So almost 90% of the young people surveyed said they had made a connection through the program with an adult who really cares about them. We also know how important it is that young people attach with their parents, knowing that over a lifetime, it will impact their self-esteem, their mental health, and your personal satisfaction. And it, again, interviewing the young people, we hear from them that 72% saying their relationship with their parents, their guardians, or their caregivers was better or a lot better after the time that they had spent in the program. As mentioned, homeless and runaway youth are quite vulnerable. They're at risk of becoming involved in crime, delinquency, and other behaviors that jeopardize their health and safety, and also the health and safety and property of others around them. Once involved in the criminal justice system, the cost to the community of dealing with them becomes many times more expensive than supporting them in the kinds of community-based programs we're talking about today. So depending on the behavior, whether it's sexual favors, crime, delinquency, drug dealing, or gang activity, the youth that we interviewed reported that while in the program, they did not become involved in any serious trouble at all or put themselves at risk. So when youth were asked how much better things worked for them now compared to how they were before they came to the program, 77% said that they stay out of trouble with the law. Two-thirds reported that their school attendance had become better or a lot better. So in short, based on the self-report from the youth, the programs are getting the youth who participate back on track, helping them to stay out of trouble, attend school, or work or collect benefits for which they're eligible. In closing, I'll talk about the two to three benefits that young people all identified as being important as a result of their involvement in these programs, and not surprisingly, they mentioned food, shelter, housing, jobs, and health with school. But another important finding, and this was consistent across all of the groups that were conducted, was the quality of the relationships the youth had with staff and the support they received from the staff. And in the words of one young person in a Duluth area program talking about the benefits of their relationship with staff, they said how important it was to them to have someone who cares, knowing that they won't give up on you, that they won't dump you off. So I thank you for your attention this morning. I look forward to preparing, completing our report sometime this month, and we'd be happy to send that to members of the committee who are interested. And I'll close with one story. Make it very brief. I've been doing research for close to 40 years. I've interviewed thousands, probably tens of thousands of people in that time. And in every project, something sticks with me. You hear something that you can't get out of your mind. In one of the focus groups, one young man described to us how, and he was gay, he came out to his parents. And when he did that, they physically attacked him. He ran out the door with his mother in pursuit. She got in the car, chased him down the street, and drove up on the sidewalk trying to run him down. So we're not talking about running away. We're talking about running from. So I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Cullen. Any questions for committee members and these two witnesses? Dr. Cullen, before you leave, I wanted to ask you one question. I think one of the statistics is quite remarkable. The 77% that stayed out of trouble with the law. I think one of the things that helps in some of these discussions is a cost-benefit analysis.
Sure.
And I'm just wondering in your report when you finalize it, if you could actually Give us that breakdown, because I think it'll help us, you know, in terms of
funding. There's some of the stats I had reported here, and these are from youth who the street outreach programs are in touch with. I mean, 15% of them report drug dealing to be able to maintain themselves on the street. 8% of them report sexual favors for food and shelter. So when we think of the long-term consequences, not only for these young people, but in terms of disease, the community, spread of STDs, in terms of drug sales, and the implications for community involved in theft and so on, I think it would be worth doing a cost-benefit analysis. I don't think we have the resources to do it right now, but I think it's fairly obvious for every one of these young people who doesn't go into the CJ system, we know what it costs to keep a young person in an institution.
Okay. Just that number, what do you say it is today, that number?
By comparison, I don't know what it costs for a day in one of your programs.
That's probably one of the things that maybe one of the witnesses can tell us as we go forward today.
But I can say for out-of-home placements, we know that it's costing $350,
$400
a day.
Yeah. That's good.
So,
Thank you very much. Those are the kind of numbers that sometimes help us do the right thing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While we're waiting for the next witnesses, there is a letter from the mayor of Minneapolis that's been passed around. Supports this bill 100% and understands the importance of capturing these youth early and giving them the leg up.
Right, there's a letter from Mayor Archie Rydak that's been passed to all of us. I think one of the lines in here that's very striking is the very first sentence. There are few people more vulnerable than a teenager without a home. Welcome to the committee, and if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Simonette. I am the Director of Catholic Charities Hope Street Programs for Runaway and Homeless Youth. We are current recipients of the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act funding, which assists us in providing outreach, shelter, and housing services to homeless youth in crisis. In our current economic climate, our ability to raise supplemental funds from charitable contributions has been particularly challenging. The flexible funding from the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act has provided some stability for us to help us continue to deliver quality services during difficult economic times. We are seeing several concerning trends in our programs, particularly our shelter program. Every night our shelter is packed full. In 2008, we had over 100% utilization of our shelter beds with youth sleeping on our couches. 304 times this quarter alone, we were unable to shelter youth due to lack of vacancy. This is five times the number of youth that we turned away this same quarter 2 years ago. Just last week alone, we turned away 35 youth for shelter in 1 week. Of particular concern is the disturbing trend that we're seeing in regards to youth aging out of care and into homelessness. Over half of the youth we served in 2008 had been in and out of home placement after age 14. 15% of our referrals last quarter came directly from social workers trying to find shelter for youth who were aging out of their care. I'm in a particularly unique position to witness firsthand the realities of youth aging out of care and into homelessness. And this is because our homeless shelter shares a building with St. Joseph's Home for Children, which has several residential care units for youth in care. Just a long hallway separates our residential treatment programs and emergency shelters through the county from Hope Street's homeless youth programs. When testifying a few weeks ago, I told the story of Jasmine, who had been in and out of out-of-home placements almost all of her life. She had spent her entire 17th year in placement at St. Joe's Home for Children. Jasmine's 18th birthday was celebrated at St. Joe's with cake and presents and staff. And while the celebration was very nice, in the afternoon that same day, we packed up her belongings and walked her directly from her in-care placement, which had been her home for over a year, down the hallway to her new temporary home at Hope Street Homeless Youth Shelter. This story is neither exaggerated nor unique. While not all of the youth we see who have been in care literally walk down the hallway to us, they do come to us oftentimes directly from or soon after aging out of care. We see them from many types of facilities and coming from many different counties. What is the same is their need for ongoing support and services. In addition to this trend, we are seeing a number of youth coming to us who had previously been on medical assistance when in care and had lost their health insurance as they aged out. Many of these MA-eligible youth have been using HCMC and other hospital emergency rooms as their health care provider. They generally wait to receive acute medical attention when ill as opposed to preventative care. Many have a difficult time navigating the system to re-enroll in MA and wait until they are in a physical crisis before seeking care. The Runaway and Homeless Youth Act would allow youth to better plan for their medical needs when they age out of care as opposed to reacting to a medical crisis once they become ill. I have worked in the Runaway and Homeless Youth field for 16 years. In that time, I have never seen the need so high and the financial resources so low. At a time when charitable giving is lower than ever, we are seeing more youth and having to turn away more youth than ever. What has stayed constant over the 16 years is the youth's resiliency and their ability to have wonderfully productive adult lives when they are given targeted investment in their moments of need, targeted investment that the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act can provide. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good morning, and I want to thank you for supporting and having awareness that there are homeless teens out there, and I am one of many young women who has been a victim. My name is Rach Forsberg, and I grew up in the city of Golden Valley, just the border of Minneapolis, as my next-door neighbor. And what led me to my homelessness was I had conflicts between my family and I, and they were domestic and got verbal, and it had been ongoing, and I was put out of my house, and I had nowhere to go. I had two more months of school, of high school, and being homeless was just terrible for me. I was scared, and I did jump house to house with anybody who would take me in willingly, and I'd have to find friends who would be willing to take me after school, whether I could stay there. And I found Avenues as a real support and a great resource, but I couldn't do it. I didn't find it alone. I had my pastor help me, and I didn't know much about Minneapolis, and that was one thing that I was petrified with. I had no transportation. I'd never had ridden the bus. I never knew any resources inside Minneapolis. And when I came to Avenues for Homeless Youth, they had an amazing, outstanding support of staff. They had a lot of resources to what I needed, such as transportation to get to a job that I was currently at, medical care, food that was provided at the shelter, a stable place that I could stay in for as long as I could. And I was there for 8 months, and I was finally in a program, a transitional housing program at Linkless Apartments in RSC Eden. And it took a lot of months, but Linkless Apartments is a great, great facility to just start my independency and learn to be on my own, and has grown with me. And having been there for almost 2 months now, it is a sober place, and it does keep teens, young women and men, to stay out of trouble. And I think it is important that we continue to fund facilities like this, because there are homeless out there, and I think I'd like to also see more establishments like Avenues and Shelters in the suburb areas, because there are no resources in the suburbs, but in the city of Minneapolis. And this topic is just really important for me to tell you that, as I was a victim, it is very hard for teenagers to just know where their resources are. And I'm very blessed to know that there are youth links and bridging and the link and transitional housing where young women and men can go to and run to and just find a place to just actually start living without, and the support system is just amazing. So I'm glad, and I think we need to just be aware and tell younger generations, especially, because it has affected. And I've always been a better person, but it's made me a stronger person, and it was okay to go through it because I had a bunch of support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Forsberg, for your testimony. Very good.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lance Goodwin, and I just want to say a little bit about myself. Well, I grew up in foster care. I was in foster care from age 11 to 17. Once I turned 17, I got emancipated. And didn't nobody really tell me, you know, that there was, you know, programs, you know, out to help, you know, young adults when they get on their own. I didn't know. And I just got emancipated, and I was just out on my own. So, you know, I didn't have nowhere to go. You know, my mom, you know, when they terminated her rights, she had moved back to Indiana. That's where we're from. You know, Gary. So, it, you know, I was on my own, and you know, it is hard out here. You know, for young teens that you know don't have nowhere to go, that's homeless. You know, not in school. You know, whatever the situation is, it's hard out here. And I just thank God that there's programs such as Youth Link and other programs that's out here that's willing to even just, you know, take the time out just to talk to a young adult trying to make it out here and, you know, trying to help them out and stuff. I really think, you know, that there's programs out here because, you know, it is hard. It's really hard. But, Youth Link is a good program. You know, they helped me out with a lot of stuff as far as me getting my my ID, my state ID, going to school, you know, clothing. You know, they help you out get clothes, all that, you know, and you know, I really appreciate it, you know. I just hope that this act, you know, really goes through. I hope people take into consideration, you know, that, yes, it's real hard out here for youth, you know, and I just hope that, you know, that not just Youth Link, but other programs such as Youth Link, you know, is will always be around, you know. Hopefully, that's what I hope. I hope they'll always be around just to help, you know, youth. So that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you, Mr. Goodwin. Any questions for the witnesses? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have, if I could, an opportunity to ask Ms. Anderson Stembridge, Ms. Simonet, the two directors from Lutheran Social Services and Catholic Charities, just a quick question. I'd just like to preface it by saying we all are looking at this budget deficit. It's the numbers that I've been trying to come to, looking at the governor's proposal, we're talking about a 33% possibly cut of health and human services in the state budget. And when we hear witnesses and testifiers like this group, I think someone has to come out and say, with that level of cuts, there's nothing we can do, or practically nothing. And not to pick on the governor, because we also have a state senate, and the Minnesota House is going to be facing a similar issue. And so I'm just wondering from the two who testified earlier, whether or not the Lutheran Social Services and Catholic Charities, or the churches that they are associated with, have any program or any plans to let the public know about these kinds of needs. Because as far as I can tell, I'm looking at the numbers from polling, less than half the population are willing to make a personal sacrifice, you know, on taxes or whatever, for education. As far as for health and human services, for nursing homes and so, it doesn't even register. It's just beyond people's concerns for many people, because they're struggling, you know, trying to hang on to their jobs and worried about the fact that they've gone 20 years maybe without an increase in wages, if we factor in inflation. There is such a thing as inflation, Madam Chair. And so it's very difficult for someone like me to sit on a committee and hear this testimony and understand the political reality that we're facing. So I'd just like to ask the two presenters whether the Lutheran Church or the Catholic Church or Lutheran Social Services or Catholic Charities are planning to do anything to inform the public of the dire circumstances that we are facing in this committee and in the House of Representatives, the legislature, and our state government this time.
Ms. Simonet, maybe you're the first person on here for that, and then Ms. Simbert can come back.
Well, I know from Catholic Charities, we have a Office of Social Justice. We also have a large development department that tirelessly spends time trying to educate the public and get the word out and try to close the gap with charitable contributions, and has been pretty successful for a very long time, and has done a lot of work to try to be, I mean, our agency has tried to do a lot of work around being stable during difficult times and try to cushion the fall a little bit while trying to get the word out. But it is a reality that the in-kind contributions are way down, and the financial contributions are way down. And I think, what you know, while we try to get the word out and educate people, everybody's just kind of waiting for the storm to get through it. And the larger agencies and organizations could probably weather it a little bit better than some of the smaller ones that, you know, this might seem like a small amount compared to the gap that needs to be closed, but it could be, the life or death of some of these smaller agencies and organizations. I don't know if you want to...
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, certainly what Ms. Simonet referenced is an approach that we've also begun to take. We have begun to look internally and make as many cuts as we are able to prior to what we know is coming. And we do outreach to constituents and donors and others to help folks understand the uniqueness, the absolute challenge of what our state is facing. But I think it's such a unique situation that it oftentimes is difficult to comprehend the depth of the challenge that you all are facing, that we all as a state are facing.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Haas? I guess Representative Saylor and then Representative Haas, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question would be for Ms. Anderson Stanbridge, I believe, unless someone else wanted to answer it. I was just wondering if you could extrapolate a little bit or explain about some of the rural programs, or if your organization has any capacity for that, and what you're doing there for the same population of youth.
Certainly. And Madam Chair, Ms. Taylor, thank you for that question, because I think that in this act, if you do read the statutory language, just put a priority on Greater Minnesota programs, because there is an acknowledgement that Ms. Forsberg also indicated that we have a certain amount of capacity in the Twin Cities and the urban core, and really not that much in Greater Minnesota. There are a total of 47 shelter beds in all of Greater Minnesota. We at Lutheran Social Service do run programs in Brainerd, Duluth, Virginia, Wilmer, and Mankato, and are increasingly providing unique ways to do street outreach in those locations. Clearly, it's different than urban areas of St. Paul or Minneapolis or even the suburban areas. Two of the sites that I named, Brainerd and Duluth, did receive funds from the Runaway Homeless Youth Act. There was over twice the amount of applicants for the dollars that, of course, were able to be distributed, and that wasn't even with an attempt to try to develop some new resource. I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just one follow-up. Do you have a request from areas other than, you know, Brainerd and Duluth? I'm just wondering what your backlog is that's indicated to you of this population of youth that are in areas that you're not able to serve, or maybe you don't even have that information, but if you did, I would just be curious to know what that was. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, that information is very difficult to come by, and so the way that we have it is simply through the young people who come to our doors and come to the doors of other organizations like Evergreen in Bemidji and the Y that provides some services in Rochester. We do know that youth are safer in their communities of origin because they have more links. They have more relationships, and that we want to help them stabilize so they can ultimately have stability. And so what we see is that people especially will come to Duluth, for example, as an urban center up in the Northeast, whereas we would prefer that there were opportunities for them in the smaller locations that they're from. But I can help you to get a little bit more information if you'd like. Mrs. House?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure who could answer this question, or maybe I'm reading the bill wrong, but if you start on line 11 and go through to the end of line 12, where it says, must be enrolled in medical assistance. Now, I know two couples that have foster children. The small church I go to in Walker, I believe there are 7 foster kids in that church with 3 different families, and everything is wonderful, everything is good. So I'm wondering if the must be enrolled is, what if they don't want to be? What if they've got the world by the tail, so to speak? Would it be better to say maybe, or on their 18th first birthday and an application is filled out, then they must be, but why would we say they just must be? It's almost like saying we would ensure Wheelock Whitney's kids if they were taken care of by someone else. I'm just a little confused with the language. Is it necessary to say it that way?
Ms. Simmerd or Representative Rosenthal?
Madam Chair, Representative House. Medicaid is always the last resort. So if the young person did have other ways to have their medical needs covered, then certainly through employment or other opportunities, that would be appropriate for them. We use the term must in this case because young people who do age out of the system are eligible. What we tend to see is that because they're 18-year-olds, that they have difficulties when they move place to place maintaining the enrollment or filling out the paperwork. And so because, as we've talked about, that this is a vulnerable group of young people and also a fairly small group of young people, we feel that it's more prudent to assure that that enrollment can maintain itself. And as one final comment, Representative House, thank you for bringing up the wonderful foster parents in your community. Talking about some of the unfortunate experiences that young people have certainly is not an attempt at all to paint over the foster care system. We are very grateful for all the many wonderful foster parents there are out there. We're simply seeking to improve the system so as young people age out, they have greater stability.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the way you put that. I still have a great deal of problem with must be enrolled. Unless it's changed, I wouldn't be able to vote for the bill.
Madam Chair? Representative House, as I read the language, it just says that they must be certified eligible, but it doesn't say that they have to take coverage, just that they're eligible for coverage if they want it.
Representative House, I think the other point here, too, is that these are when they're in foster care, this is when the commissioners or counties have trustee and financial responsibility. I presume that's when they're not with their foster parent, or is that when they're? So these are young people who are not with a foster family. Is that right? Am I understanding that correctly? I think we need a little clarification. I can tell you one thing. This part of the bill is in Representative Huntley's committee, and I know they were taking a look at it in there too, right? So I'm not sure.
Madam Chair, maybe you could have staff from Huntley's committee just clarify it. Explain what that means. They
we'll
probably deal with this all the time. They probably know better.
Sure, we'll do that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, and simply as a point of clarification, the language is moving in other committees, and so certainly we can follow up with you on that question. And the intent of this discussion is to have that holistic presentation and then to amend out all the language that doesn't pertain to the jurisdiction of this committee and the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. So you won't be asked to vote on that.
Would that be then sections 1, 3, and 4 that would be removed? Is that going to happen today?
Yes.
Okay. But I think your question is still an important question, and we'll try to get it answered anyway, even though that will be coming apparently out of this bill, because it's funded in the other bill. Okay, thank you. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and I got a couple questions here. One is, you just said that we're, this committee is addressing 1, 4, 3, and 4?
No, those will be removed from this bill, 1, 3, and 4.
And it's kind of along the same lines as Representative House was talking about. I think in line 1.12, I think it's pretty explicit there. The MUC says they need to be enrolled in medical assistance upon completion of an application. That's what the law says. So we are mandating this. And I was wondering if you have a fiscal note that comes along with this particular process.
Who would care to answer that? December?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, yes, there will be a fiscal note, and that hasn't exactly been finalized, and again, won't be before this committee, and so it will be before Mr. Howley's committee.
I guess we're not covering Section 2. I was just curious as to what the reason is for getting rid of the follow-up information for the runaway. Basically, it says the 4% of funds appropriated may be used for the purpose of monitoring, evaluating runaway homeless youth programs receiving funding out of this section. And so we're getting way rid of that accountability process, and I was wondering what's the rationale for that.
Actually, just to correct Representative Susan, that will be continued in this one. Section 2 is part of the bill. So if that could be answered perhaps by the author or one of the witnesses.
Madam Chair, in the 2007 version of this bill, there was specific language that required an evaluation to be conducted, and that's what Dr. Cohen was speaking to, because this was the first time that this body did choose to invest in that continuum for homeless youth, and so we don't need this to see that continued into the future, because he has done the comprehensive evaluation on the program, and especially in this fiscal environment, we'd rather see those dollars go to immediate program needs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And kind of along those lines, I'm wondering if maybe the author knows what percentage of runaway and homeless youth that we have that this bill is addressing come from the foster care parenting program, and what are the numbers that basically are outside the foster care. In other words, those that are coming out of family, maybe a problem household or whatever. Do we have any of those numbers?
Madam Chair, Representative. Again, it's very difficult to track this information. However, as you can see in the Wilder study before you, over 70% of young people who do experience homelessness acknowledge that they've had some sort of out-of-home placement. That doesn't necessarily mean that they have aged out into homelessness, however. And again, that data is not information that we have before us, unfortunately.
Just a follow-up statement, if I could, Madam Chair. I understand the intent of this bill, and I understand that, you know, that we have some issues with homeless children out there. My major concern with this process would be that we begin to undermine some of the family structure by creating a pressure vent, if you will. And I know as a parent and as, you know, as being a child myself, going through the teens is somewhat a new experience in many contexts for parents and for teens. And sometimes when we release the pressure from the ability of the family to cope with these situations, keep the situation within the family unit by opening up a venue where kids can get the word out and say, hey, if you're having problems in your family, come down to this youth center down here, because we've got some place where you can stay and use it as a retreat, puts an unnecessary challenge into the family, I think. And maybe you can address that. Hopefully you've addressed that in the studies here, and you've got a great answer for it.
Madam Chair, I can speak from the experience that we have at through our agency. When youth come to the shelter housing program through our outreach program, the very first thing that we look at is family reunification and family structure and system. And we define family very broadly. Any, you know, positive adult support system out there already in place that we can help to reinforce. And sometimes our data tells us right now is in the last year, 12% of the youth that we served, we were able to reunify with family. The vast majority of youth coming to us have parents who have lost parental rights, parents who are deceased, parents who have moved out of the area and the youth has no contact with them, parents who are incarcerated, parents that are using, abusing drugs or alcohol, very dysfunctional homes. Some of the youth, the 12% that are reunified, we try to move on very quickly. We know that the longer a youth is homeless, the more at risk they are. So we try to move them on quickly. There is a small percentage above that 12% that we can try to maintain family relationship with. So the youth sees the family, they have communication with them, they maybe aren't able to just jump right back in and move home, but can maintain a relationship. But the vast majority, over 75% of youth that we serve, there is no possibility for family reunification at the point that they come to our shelters and job in, or at transitional housing program. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there any other testimony? Oh, Representative Hayden, I'm sorry. I see that you had your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. Just a kind of a quick question for Mr. Goodwin. You had said that you entered the foster care program at 11 years old, and then at 17 you were emancipated, and that your mom lost her parental rights. At what age did she lose her parental rights? If you may, I mean, and I only want you to say what you feel comfortable with.
She lost her parental rights when we first got. It was me and my sisters. She lost her parental rights to all three of us when it happened. When I was 11.
11 years old.
Yeah.
And then, Madam Chair, Mr. Good, when you said that at 17 you emancipated, can you talk about your decision or kind of your path of how you decided to emancipate at 17 as opposed to 18 legally? Can you talk a little bit about that decision and why you did it or how you got to that point of deciding to do it?
Well, I thought about it, for a while, but I kind of, my reasons was at the time, the social worker that I had, her name was Stacey McClendon. I was making bad decisions, I was kind of, skipping school a little bit and stuff, and I guess my social worker, she wanted to put me in institutions, I guess, she had me in one way out in Duluth, Minnesota, away from people that I knew. I'm not familiar with Duluth, none of that, and she had me way out there, and I didn't think that, that was a good place to, put me at the time. That's some of the things that me and my social worker, would, it was a lot of other stuff. I really can't get into detail, but being in the system, there's your ups, but there's your downs too. It's a lot of stuff, you got to deal with being in the system, and I just felt at the time, I wanted out. I just figured that I'll just make it on my own, no matter what, no matter how bad it is out here, I'll just make it on my own. So that was the decision I made.
Madam Chair, I think what I'm trying to illustrate is just how tough it is, and decisions that a 17-year-old young person has to make in terms of trying to figure out how to navigate the world, how to figure out what structure they want to be in, being moved away from their family and friends, not wanting to do that, then the only alternative is to go on their own, unprepared to deal, if I may say, Mr. Goodwin, with kind of a lot of the things that are in front of them. So I think it really illustrates that this, the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, and it really helps to give young people the proper support that they need in order to start to navigate and make those decisions. And as Representative Severson said, which I agree with, that adolescents are going through the teenage years are pretty tough, and they are pressure-packed, and that in the unfortunate incident that you don't have your parents there to support you, I think to be able to have places like Youth Link and the Bridge and the Link and all of those things to really help you think about the decisions that you want to make better choices is a worthwhile and wise investment for us here at the state. So thanks again, Mr. Goodwin, and I'm sorry I forgot your name.
Okay.
And Grace, it's fantastic to see you guys in front of us, and we hope we can continue to help out other young people, including yourself, as you move forward.
Thank you. Representative
Rosenthal. Chair, I still want to make one comment. Representative Severson, both Lance and Grace are great examples of how this program helps kids. In no way is it an easy place to be? And people, just because they're having trouble being a teenager in a family, they don't want to be in this situation. That's not what they're looking for. This is helping people in grave need. And, you know, it's the right thing to do. It's smart policy. In the end, I believe it saves money.
Okay. So, thank you all very much for excellent testimony. Representative Rosenthal, did you want to move to remove those three sections, Section 1, 3, and 4, from this bill now?
Yes, I would propose an amendment to delete Sections 1, 3, and 4.
Okay. That motion is before us. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and those sections are deleted. Now the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, testifiers.
Members, we're having an informational hearing on the next bill. This bill is not before us for action, but it is for us for consideration. And I, Representative Susan, I see you have an amendment. We can certainly talk about it. We're just not going to be taking the action on anything, but we can look at your amendment when it comes time. So, Representative Hayden, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We have House File 1989, which I want to reiterate is just for informational purposes only, where is going to be a considerable amount of testimony is kind of pro and con for this idea, and I think that in the climate that we're in today, based on all of the things that we have to look at, we thought that it wasn't appropriate to move it this year, but it is a placeholder. It is something that I think we need to think about. House File 1989 increases the state D-tax from 0.0033% to 0.005%, and the net consideration between the two to fund programs that the Minnesota Housing and Finance Agency would use for affordable housing. Specifically, it would send 42% of it to the Housing Trust Fund, 33% to the Challenge Program that we talk about a lot here, remaining 25% to the HALO, our Housing Account for Leverage Opportunity account for developing and providing affordable housing throughout our state. 1 in 8 Minnesota households are paying more than half of their income for housing, and that was from 2006, before we had the current economic recession that we're in today. Most people living in housing, they cannot afford, receive little to no help even in the good times. With the possibility of cuts, those lucky enough to get help today may not receive it tomorrow, as Representative Benson talked about in the last bill. In today's Star Tribune reports that our safety net is in tatters, shelters are full and turning record numbers away, food shelves are facing record demands, so on and so forth. What House File 1989 will do, the Housing Solutions Act, is just a small part of what we can do to prop up the state's investment in affordable housing. I personally have worked on affordable housing issues for the last 10 years, and I know that part of the process is that there's a pipeline to this. So starting to really think about this issue, we have more and more people headed towards an affordable housing solution because they've lost their jobs, or they've lost their place to live, or their wages simply aren't keeping up the pace with their rent or their mortgage. It's something that we really need to think about. When adjusted for inflation, Minnesota's investment in affordable housing is less than half of what it was at the beginning of this decade. I'll read that again. When adjusted for inflation, Minnesota's investment in affordable housing is less than half of what it was at the beginning of this decade. We've made investments, but it's been with one-time funds more often than not. The Housing Solution Act proposes a potential fix, a significant dedicated source of investment in affordable housing. So what we want to do today is just to explore the opportunity of raising more funds through a D tax. It is the kind of nasty word around here sometimes, is tax. And I say that not facetiously. I think that often we kind of polarize around where we fit with the tax, but I can tell you that there are folks in my district that are very concerned about having taxes as well. I talk to people all the time, people in my district here, that talk about it. So I think that when we do talk about revenue raising and taxes, we need to do it smartly. And I'm hoping that as we think about increasing, as we get more people moving towards affordable housing that they have to live in, that this is a smart investment that we take on the purchase or sale of new properties. Today I have Michael Dahl and Jerry Foss, who will kind of testify to some of the issues that they have seen as it relates to affordable housing and the development of it.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Members of the committee, my name is Michael Dahl, and I'm the Public Policy Director with Homeline. Last week, Madam Chair, you asked homeless service providers to tell you how much it would cost to end homelessness. It's a smart question, but you were asking the wrong people. Asking homeless service providers how they're going to end homelessness is a lot like asking the volunteers who did the sandbagging in Fargo and Moorhead how their work was going to stop the Red River from reaching 41 feet or higher. The volunteers did great work to stop that crisis from getting even worse. And I would say that the volunteers and the staff that work in homeless programs do an amazing job. Food shelves do an amazing job. Domestic violence programs do an amazing job. They do an amazing job to help people in crisis. But the fact of the matter is, we're having more and more people fall in crisis because folks can't meet their basic necessities. They either don't make enough to afford housing, food, other basic necessities, or those things just cost much more than they used to. I use as a frame of reference the how much we spent on housing at the beginning of this decade, because I remember back then was when the legislature was alerted through a report from the legislative auditor that the 1990s were terrible for renters. Their incomes rose by 3%, and the cost of housing was way beyond that. And so this legislature started taking a really, really strong role in taking a look at what to do about affordable housing. You paid a lot of attention, and I thank you for that. But what's happened is we've used one-time funding, and sometimes we've fallen back. The trajectory has been going down when the need has been going up. In 2006, before the economy tanked, 220,000 renter households could not afford where they lived. Many of them received little to no help. Imagine being one of those renters right now. You're going to see your rent increase because there are more people flooding the renters market because foreclosures are having homeowners turn into renters. Vacancy rates are going down. Rents are going up. I'd be scared, really scared. And I know that Minnesota, just as an educated someone who knows a bit about the work that you do, they know that you've done a lot of work to try to address homelessness and affordable housing, but many of the fixes really are there to help people once they fall into crisis or for targeted populations who really do need a lot of help. But if you're just a regular old renter out there who has struggled for years, there's not much there for you, and many of the federal supports that have been put in place to be there for people like that have eroded over the past decade as well. We were asked about 4 years ago by a legislator to say, what are we going to do to get ahead of this problem? What are other states doing? And we looked really, really hard. Now, where we raise money is not as important as the people we need to help. But we do want to raise the money in a way that is progressive and is a significant investment. 13 other states use a deed tax to raise money for housing, and it's worked very well. But what's most important is how are we going to use resources to help as many people as possible. And so what the Housing Solutions Act proposes is that we put money into the Housing Trust Fund. This Housing Trust Fund can be used for a lot of different purposes, but we would target these resources towards rental assistance for extremely low-income households. We have put 33% of the resources into the Challenge Fund. And as you know, the budget that came before you a few weeks back proposes cutting $23.5 million from the Challenge Fund. And there's also a local incentive fund so that localities that want to put some money up or some resource up to address housing will have a state match. These are, in the case of the Challenge Program and the Housing Trust Fund, effective programs and a great state agency that knows how to administer the funds. But we've had fewer funds available for them to meet their job. And so that's what the Housing Solutions Act is all about. Before I turn it over, I just want to say I know that you have an incredible job before you, and you must be getting sick of hearing that, because every time someone comes before you, they say, I know an incredible job that you have. It's a terrible budget situation, but it's just a reflection of what's going on in the community. What happens at the end of the end of May if we don't put more money into housing programs? Your communities will look weaker. There'll be more people in need. And the next year, there'll be more demand. And we'll be asking for even more help. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jerry Foss. I am a realtor with Edina Realty. I have been for almost 20 years. And I'm sorry, I don't have prepared statements for you today. I just came here to talk to you a little bit about why I feel this act is important. So I'll go forward. The reason that I feel like this is important is because neighborhoods that I specifically work in, as well as other realtors, are neighborhoods that are under a lot of stress. And whenever I am out working with a buyer looking for a house, we drive through a neighborhood with a tremendous amount of foreclosures. The last thing in the world that buyer wants to do is make an investment in that neighborhood. What that has the effect of is it reduces the price of every house in that neighborhood which has significant foreclosures. It's a spiral. It's every time there is another homeowner that has their prices reduced further because of the other foreclosures on the block, they get further and further down in their values, which brings them closer and closer to not having enough equity to be able to sell their homes, which puts another home in either a short sale or foreclosure situation. So it's a spiraling effect that has to be stopped somehow. I understand that the state is having tremendous budgetary problems right now and trying to find additional funds to stop what is going on is not even going to be possible without the additional revenue. This revenue comes directly from sellers. It does not come from buyers. This does not affect buyers in any way. Right now, over 40%, and I wish I had the exact number, but it's between 40 and 50% of transactions in the, I don't know whether it's the metro area or the state, but anyway, over 40% of the transactions are lender-mediated transactions. Mm-hmm. That means that the deed tax is being paid by the banks. It is not being paid by a homeowner. It is not being paid by a buyer. It is being paid by the banks. Another thing to be aware of is if it is there are two different types of lender-mediated transactions. One of them is a short sale. The other one is a foreclosure. A short sale simply means that the bank is agreeing to take less for the property than what is owed. The seller on this property walks away with absolutely nothing. In a foreclosure, the sellers are already gone. The property has already been deeded from that seller, oftentimes by court action, to the bank. That's one deed tax. Then this property is sold and it is deeded to a buyer, another deed tax. So in a foreclosure, we are getting double deed taxes. I do not know what the percentage of deed taxes that are collected at the state level, the county level, I do not know what percentage of those come from lenders, but I would suggest that it is significantly higher than 50%. Right now, we are in a position where the real estate market is starting to improve slightly. However, we are, by all reports, ready for another wave of foreclosures when the option arms come. So we are looking at significantly more lender-mediated transactions. And with lender-mediated transactions, again, we're getting the money from the banks. The importance of having neighborhoods that are stable to a city, whether it's Minneapolis or whether it's Bemidji, the neighborhoods that are not stable often have the spiral effect. We now have, you know, leaks. It's like in a bathtub, and you have little holes punched in it all over the place. It's little leaks of these neighborhoods. This, with the current or the coming wave of foreclosures, it will have the effect of basically pulling the plug out of the bathtub and just draining it. And this will spread not just to the inner core, where a lot of people think, well, you know, that's an inner city issue. It is not an inner city issue. It is already moving to the suburbs and to the exurbs and to the rural areas. So it may be primarily an inner city problem last year. This year it is already being evidenced that it is not. And it is moving further and further into the suburbs and exurbs. And each member of the committee, whenever you start having a foreclosure on your block, your house value just dropped. And this is one way that we can stop the tide of foreclosures. So, thank you.
Mr. Foss, is there any comments or questions about this? Okay. Oh, Representative Stevenson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just kind of curious. You're already talking about a brutalized economy here, mm-hmm. and how it's taken a nosedive. And Madam Chair, we had this bill a couple years ago, and I think we had the foresight to table it and just say, you know what, let's wait and see what transpires here. And since that time frame, we've seen record numbers of foreclosures go into effect here. So now you're talking about trying to tax an industry that is already under tremendous pressures. And I'm just wondering, what's the rationale for that?
This is not taxing the industry. This is not taxing the industry at all. It's a very small, insignificant amount of money whenever it comes from a seller's point of view. When I sit down with a seller and discuss with them what their fees are going to be, we're talking about anywhere from 7 to 9% total in fees that they're going to pay on the costs of selling their home. And if I tell them they have another $200 fee or another $225 fee or another $300 fee, they do not blink, they do not bat an eye. The real estate companies have instituted a policy in the last few years of what is called a broker's administrative commission. This runs anywhere from $230 to $300, sometimes even more than that. When this fee was instituted, the realtors were all up in arms. Oh my God, how are we going to explain this to our sellers? That went away in about 6 months once we realized that all we had to do was explain to them that this is a fee. They still talk about commission. They talk about commissions and wanting to reduce commissions now, exactly like they did before this. This had absolutely zero effect on our ability to explain what a fee was to a seller.
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Dahl.
I just want to point out that the dollar figure on the pain, I think, should be measured from the other perspective. There are people out there who the fix to them has not, there has been no help to them, and there is a cost related to that. Now, we can ask what's the right place to try to raise the resources to help, but we first should say that we need to help. I mean, 220,000 rental households can't afford where they live. And we have asked each year, when we've had the Housing Solutions Act, please come to us with a better proposal for how to raise the money if you think it's there, but 13 other states have done this, and it's had a positive influence. And I'd be happy to get some information about that for you if you want some more details. But we're always open to a way to make this work better. But the key is we want to help the people who aren't getting help right now.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to handle one at a time here, and I think the first one was, I forget your name, sir.
Gary Foss.
Mr. Foss. Yeah, you said to the sellers it's insignificant. Well, I would kind of contend with that, particularly in this housing market, when we've got people who have seen the devaluation, and they're going upside down in their houses. They're having to buy to get out of their housing so they can retain their credit. And so I think that is one of the serious things we're looking at in this community in terms of foreclosures, is why would we heap more damage onto the people who are in a tenable situation to start with, and now we're asking them to... And then the other issue that you talked about is when these go into foreclosures, and then the deed is paid off by the bank, and then it goes into another transaction that the deed tax is actually paid twice. So now we're actually talking about hitting not just the banks, but then the individuals who are coming to pay for that particular unit housing up front, which adds on to the end bill. Somebody's going to pay the tax. And so I just foresee this is like, how do we dig ourselves out of a hole? Dig deeper. Maybe we're on a spot then.
Yes, I'd like to. Okay, let me respond to, first of all, the last one that you mentioned, heaping the tax on, and that somebody has to pay it. I will say this, as a homeowner myself, who has lost a tremendous amount of value in my own home. In fact, I own two properties, and both of them have lost a tremendous amount of money, a tremendous amount of value. I know that if there were something in place to prevent some of my neighbors from going into foreclosure, for me to spend $250 or $300 more when I sell my property to prevent many of my neighbors from going into foreclosure would have been money very well spent. If I spend $300 to prevent my home value from dropping $50,000, that is a huge return on my investment. So I'll say that. And another thing, may I?
Okay.
Please? I'm sorry. Another thing, you mentioned that the banks have to pay, there has to collect two deed taxes. That is correct. Both paid by the bank. Both of those deed taxes are paid by the bank.
Actually, the deed tax does not apply to foreclosures. It does apply to other sales. But in the case of a foreclosure, in the a deed tax is not charged.
Okay.
No. And I'd be happily get you the information on that. The tax expenditure budget outlines certain times that the deed tax does not apply, and foreclosure is one.
Okay, Representative
Stevenson. Yeah, Madam Chair, I guess I could go on with some issues. I won't hold up the committee's time here, and there are other questions, I'm sure.
Representative Scott.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this goes to Mr. Faust, is it?
Faust.
Mm-hmm. One of us will get it right here eventually. You know, you mentioned that if you could pay $300 or $400 to prevent your neighbor's home from going into foreclosure, aren't there a multitude of programs out there now with the federal stimulus package and with all these things that money's being appropriated to keep, we're already trying to prevent that from happening?
There are several programs. It's just not enough.
So what in your mind would be enough?
Well, this would be a step in the right direction.
Okay. Just Madam Hayden. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Just as a perspective, my husband and I own just a handful of rental properties, and one of them, particularly in St. Paul, the property taxes have gone up to the point since we probably own this 10 years, and the property taxes have gone up so much that we barely break even. We don't break even on that property. We go in the hole every month. We can't raise rent because the rental, we have plenty of vacancies in the city of St. Paul, Minneapolis. We have a property in New Hope that we had an apartment vacant now for 2 months. We've lowered the rent twice. We've lowered the rent by $100. So I don't see it as being a shortage of affordable housing as much as maybe what, you know, I'm in that market, so I see it every day. And I don't, from what you're telling me, it doesn't jive with what's happening in our own lives.
Representative Scott and Mr. Faust and others that are in this market answer those questions. I did want to say, though, Representative Scott, that a lot of the money that has come down from the federal stimulus program on neighborhood stabilization really is targeted towards properties that are already vacant or foreclosed on. Mm-hmm. So there has been a tremendous amount of money that is kind of coming into the pipeline. It doesn't necessarily work with those that are kind of having trouble or even new construction, if you will. It is to try to stabilize neighborhoods that have already had the foreclosures.
Madam Chair,
okay, final comment, and then we have two more witnesses.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I don't have the handout, but I think you do. There's something from the Minnesota Housing Partnership that outlines what's happening with rents right now, and on the back of that sheet, it shows that there are decreasing vacancy rates and higher rents, and this comes from a quarterly survey that is done of properties. And so your example may not be that case, and if it isn't in the packet, my apologies. But we are seeing, yes, that page, you can see on the right side, the column midway down the page on the second side, shows what's happening to rent and vacancy rates at this point. Long and short of it is that we have 220,000 households that can't afford where they live.
All right, well, thank you very much for your testimony. We do have two other witnesses that have asked to testify, Christine Berger from Minnesota Association of Realtors and Chris Dollar from Minnesota Association of Realtors. We'll take them next. And then, I don't know, Representative Stevenson, if you want to just say a few minutes about what your amendment is, but we won't be taking any action on any of this. But, well, welcome to the committee. And I'm sorry we only have a brief few minutes here, but let's get a handout there. A couple handouts, okay. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, and Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christine Berger, and I represent the 20,000 members of the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And the Minnesota Association of Realtors respectfully asks you to oppose House File 1989. It does increase the state deed tax rate by over 50%. And the deed tax is a hidden and regressive property tax. It increases the cost of housing, making it less affordable, so it does impact both buyers and sellers. It singles out buyers and sellers to pay for a societal issue that should be paid for by the broad base of taxpayers. The tax increase would come at a time of declining market values, and during a significant time of an increase in short sales. This legislation most definitely would have an impact on people who are going through a short sale. They do pay this tax. It's not yet transferred to the lender. The sellers in a short sale would pay this tax. So they are upside down, and they must sell their home short of what is owed. They have no equity, and they will have to pay this increased tax along with any outstanding balance on their mortgage. The realtors are trying to stimulate the housing market. Now is not the time to add additional taxes on the sellers who are having a hard time selling their property, and sometimes properties will sit on the market for months. On a $200,000 property, the proposal before you would increase the deed tax from $660 to $1,000. Now, typically, there's also the transfer property, there's also a mortgage on the property, and there's a mortgage registry tax. So on say this house had a $190,000 mortgage, then the mortgage registry tax would be $437, making a combined mortgage registry and deed tax of $1,437 to transfer this one property. The costs are even higher in Hennepin and Ramsey County due to their local mortgage registry and deed tax surcharges. The deed tax also applies to the transfer of rental property. For example, if you were selling a $5 million rental property with 50 units, and if you impose this proposed deed tax on it, it would be a $25,000 tax, which is $500 a unit, which would clearly have an impact on rental prices. Not only is this transfer tax falling on people who have less cash to put down, but it also falls on more heavily on lower value properties because they tend to turn over more often and more frequently than higher value properties do. Minnesota has clearly reached a peak or near peak in homeownership rates, and yet we still seem to see declines in market values, but we still have one of the highest homeownership rates in the nation. We're very proud of that. The federal government actually abandoned this tax back in 1976. Because they felt it was a discriminatory tax, because it was inequitable that individuals with unequal financial conditions have to pay the same tax rate. So just to conclude my share of the testimony, our median sales price in Twin Cities is $150,000. Over the last 2 years, the median sales price has dropped over $73,000. It is an impressive drop in price. We do have, homes have become more affordable, and we also have record interest rates. And as my realtor members would want me to say, now is a great time to buy.
Madam Chair, my name is Chris Galler. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and I'm going to cover some other details related to the bill. First is related to housing affordability, and it's important to know that the Housing Affordability Index is an index that's been tracked since 1970. It compares a household median income compared to a median-priced home in a particular marketplace. If the number is 100, that means that the median family income is high enough to purchase a median valued home. 100 means across the board. Right now in the Twin Cities metropolitan area and throughout Minnesota, it's over 200. It's the highest it's been since that number has been tracked. And it's important to note that it's 49% higher than it was in 2007, just a couple of years ago when we discussed this bill. It's also important that at $150,000, the home values, as Christine went through, have dropped actually $80,000 since the peak, which was 3 years ago in 2006. That's a 35% drop. We went through and ran the numbers on that. If you were to purchase a median valued home in the metropolitan area, of which in greater Minnesota homes are a little bit less expensive, but if you were to purchase it using 5% down, reasonable number, using conservative ratio, 28% income, 36% debt, you would need to have, and using a 5.5% mortgage rate, a 30-year fixed rate, you'd need an income of $48,000. If you were to purchase a $200,000 home, you'd need an income of $66,000. We've provided you with the details below in the sheet that you've got. What's even more impressive about affordability in the metropolitan area is that since 1998, home values have really only gone up a few thousand dollars. Because of the slide in the marketplace right now, the median value of a home in 1998 was $147,000. February 2009, it's $150,000. At the same time, using the HUD numbers for income, we know that the median family income in the metropolitan area at that time in 1998 was $58,000. Today, it's at $83,900. So the median family has more than enough income to purchase a median-priced home in this marketplace. And keep in mind, median means there's as many available above as below that number. The bill targets, if you'll read through, you'll see that the bill targets consumers at 115% of the area median income. 115%. So that means if the median income is 83.9, which HUD released last week in their 2009 figures, that means we're looking at helping homeowners with incomes of $96,000. Now, if in your district consumers have a problem purchasing a home with an income of $96,000, I would suggest it's not a housing affordability problem. If you go further down, you'll see that statewide, because the bill indicates that it's a statewide area median or family income or area, whichever is higher. So for the rest of the state, it's 72.9 times 115,000, that's $83,000. Again, most of Minnesota, you can afford to buy a house if you're earning $83,000. We laid this out because we actually put the documentation in here. My son was actually amazed because he graduated from college, and I told him that he was a very low-income person now because the job he has only pays him $28,500 a year. And I said, well, congratulations, you're now very low-income. He doesn't feel low-income, by the way. He assumes that he'll do better as time goes by, as I think most people do as they're young and moving forward. We agree with some of the stuff Michael talked about in the housing advocates earlier. We've met with Chip Holbeck, worked with Julian, and others trying to come up with it. There is an affordability problem for people that earn less than $20,000 a year. Whether they own a home or rent, the fact is that they don't have enough money in this marketplace to afford a home. But before we fix the affordability problem, before we look at deed taxes on foreclosures and short sales, the fact is the foreclosures and short sales are a small part of the marketplace in a normal market. We're usually looking at 2 to 4% of the homes. Right now, it's an anomaly. When you pass tax policy, that goes on forever. When we return to normal, guess what? Your constituents will be paying that deed tax. That's just the way the marketplace works. Right now, what we also don't have is an idea when we look at the community housing survey of the people that do pay more than 30% of their income in housing. How do we know it's just for housing? We know, as we talk to our members throughout the state, that a number of people have second and third mortgages. They bought cars, they took vacations, they bought boats, they bought snowmobiles, they did all kinds of stuff. Well, guess what? They're now paying more than 30%, but it's not because of the housing. Because they decided to spend the dollars on things other than housing. Again, we're not in argument about the people earning less than $20,000 a year, even people earning less than $30,000 a year. In this marketplace, it's tough to make it all. But this bill doesn't do this. This bill looks at a whole bunch of people. The other part of the bill is, on affordability, is the bill directs funds to cities, counties, HRAs, EDAs, land trusts, and some other groups. That means that the groups that actually participate in the program will be able to direct the funds. That doesn't mean the neighbor that lives in back of me right now that's going through a short sale benefits from it. That means that a city or a county or an HRA or an EDA that comes up with a program or a project that they'd like to see, those benefits. And so everybody gets to pay, but only a few may get the benefit in the project. In conclusion, we urge that you don't have a 50% increase on property taxes, or at least the deed tax in the state. We agree there needs to be a funding source. We had Senator Marty last week testify because he's known our position for years. This is a societal problem. There are some people in the society that make less than others. Therefore, it should be a societal cure. It shouldn't say this society problem should be paid for by those selling property in the state of Minnesota. It should be a society cure. Or the other alternative, as Michael points out, 13 other states have a deed tax that's dedicated to housing. We offered that in the meetings with Julian, with Chip, with others to say, you currently have a deed tax. Use those dollars. Just don't raise the taxes on people right now when the housing market is in the worst shape it's been for years.
We're out of time. I really appreciate your testimony. Representative Hayden, you might want to make a final comment. Representative Stevenson has before us an amendment. Can you just briefly explain what your amendment would have done, even though we're not going to act on it because we're not taking action on the bill at all? But.
Yeah, Madam Chair, basically what the amendment does is it keeps it at the current level at 0.033 and takes half of those funds and then puts them into an affordable housing fund that would go towards this issue. And it would create a hole in the general fund, but I think it would go to the issue that I think we're talking about here in terms of, you know, some dedicated funding in that process. So that's basically what the amendment does.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Ms. Hayden, a final word, and we do have to
I know we have to go, Madam Chair. Thank you so much. I just want to say thank you to everybody for paying attention to this issue. Clearly, even Representative Stevenson's amendment to redirect funds to affordable housing, I think, shows a bipartisan support that there is an affordable housing problem, and I look forward over the, you know, however long it takes for us to really sit down and to work on this issue, to work with all of the stakeholders, advocates, and members about an issue that I think is near and dear to our heart, which is getting people to pay only 30% of their income on their housing.
I want to thank you, Representative Hayden and Representative Stevenson, both for the discussion today and bringing it both of the sides forward. I hope we will keep talking about it. You know, that there's, right now we don't have plans to act on this, but you know, you never know between now and the end of the session. So, thank you so much. Let's see, the minutes are before us. Mr. McNamara, did you get a chance to look at them?
I did actually look at them. I'll move the minutes.
Representative McNamara moves the minutes of March 25th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. The meeting is adjourned.